thieves who come to rob me of my throne, of my country?" He was starting to shout now, striding to and fro, waving his arms and shooting angry glares at me. "That is the council of cowards like Damesh and Dasta and the fool Samuel. Where is he? Where is Samuel?" He looked around, stamping, but Samuel, luckily for him, wasn't on hand. Theodore stood, snarling for a moment, snapped at one of his attendants to give him a shammah, and once he'd wrapped it round his shoulders, he came muttering to me. "They will surrender, Damesh and the others. They hate me. All of them. They would run away if they had the courage. Why do they not kill me? Because they fear me by death and dare not strike." He was starting to froth again, and the mad stare was in his eyes. "Well, they had better kill me, because if they do not, I shall kill them all by the power of God, one at a time." Suddenly he seized me by the shirt, thrusting his face into mine, raving in a whisper, "You know, I must sleep with loaded pistols under my pillow. They know it too, and fear to murder me in my bed. They would poison me, but my food and drink are tasted, but I do not fear." He released his grip, closed his eyes, and began to mumble to himself as though in prayer. Then he looked up at the darkening sky, and his voice was shaking. "If he who is above does not kill me, no one will. If he says I must die, no one can save me." It came out in a yell, and I looked round to see what Gabri and his staff were making of it, but they weren't even looking at him, but busied themselves even more with the team slewing the cannon into place. They knew he was stark mad, but they were too fearful to do anything about it. And it wasn't just fear. They were enthralled to him, to the sheer power of his will and spirit. I felt it too, as well as my terror of him. He had that force that I'd seen in others, like Brook of Sarawak and old John Brown. They weren't to be resisted or reasoned with, just avoided if possible. But I couldn't avoid Theodore. And then, in a moment, the morbid fury that had possessed him so suddenly was gone, and he was striding about the gun positions, commending and criticising and even laughing. I saw him slap an ab-gunner on the shoulder and say something that set them in a roar. Then he was deep in consultation with one of his Germans, climbing up on Sevastopol to examine the firing mechanism. He was still chuckling as he came back to me, putting a hand on my shoulder, confidential-like.
"They are easy to amuse, are they not? Do you not find it so with your soldiers? Come, we shall go down and drink a little tesh together."
He seemed content to walk, nodding to the gunners and assuring them that when they were called on to load up and fire, he would be on hand to direct them. They cheered and hammered their hilts on the guns as we went down the hill.
"You heard me speak to them yesterday, my friend, did you not? Did I rouse them onto battle? Did I inspire them? Oh, my good friend, I was fakering, no more than that. But they believe, because they are simpletons and love me."
It didn't seem to occur to him that they might just as easily believe what he'd shouted at the old general, that they were doomed to defeat.
"If I say, fight, my children, they will fight, even if it means death. But are your soldiers any different, Rasflashman? Why do they do it, my friend?"
I told him because they took the shilling, the sepoys for their salt. He said it was a great mystery and waxed philosophical about the minds and motives of fighting men. Sane, sensible chat, such as you'd hear in a gathering of civilians, if not from soldiers who ain't interested. But the point is, if you'd seen and heard him then, you'd have said here was this intelligent, good-humoured, perfectly normal man of authority with not an ounce of harm in him. Quite so. We came off the phallus saddle just as it began to drizzle, with clouds gathering overhead and the light starting to fade. It was about 4 in the afternoon, and the armourers who'd been freeing prisoners were packing up their traps and shepherding those who were still chained to some old broken-down stables on the south side of the Islamgi plain, not a furlong from Theodore's tent and ours. They were to be kept there overnight and freed next day. The last of the 600 or so whom Miriam and I seen being brought down from Magdala 2 days earlier. About 200 had been freed yesterday, but only half as many today, most of the armourers having been diverted to the work on Fala. Those still chained and sent to the stables were more than 200 in number. I am exact about this so that you can be clear about how things stood on that close, sultry afternoon as I walked with Theodore and his attendants to his pavilion, aware of a slight commotion from the chained prisoners as they were driven towards the stables. I didn't know, of course, that they'd had no food since they'd left Magdala, and only such water as they'd begged from the soldiers' camp nearby. Nor did I know that most of them were political prisoners who defended, often in the most trivial way,